Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we look at the system of immigration, that is, humanity versus the system by which we control immigration into this country. What is it going to take before Congress will take up fair and just immigration reform? Do non-citizens make up a larger percentage of the overall population than they have in years past? And what about undocumented immigrants? Do they make up a larger percentage of the population of this nation than they have in the past? When someone shows up at the border claiming asylum, does the system give him or her the benefit of the doubt? And if not, why not? When you get right down to it, isn't the fight for immigrant and refugee rights a forgotten part of the fight for racial justice? There's much to discuss. And as always, you can call regarding your question on tonight's topic, immigration. You don't have to jump to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Our phone number here is 415-841-4134.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Again, Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden. The phone lines are closed.
4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, that is, if you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our attorney guests can't give you precise legal advice. They don't have all the facts relating to your case, but we're happy to pass along legal principles, help assist you in your decision-making. And the legal guidance provided mightn't be the positions of their employers or their clients, but after all, they're here to help. Joining us tonight, Professor Bill Hing founded the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in 1979 and served as volunteer executive director for its first two decades. A professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, he is the author of at least 14 books, including most recently, Humanizing Immigration, How to Transform Our Racist and Unjust System. An expert in immigration policy, negotiations, public service strategies, Asian American legal history, Bill Hing is a professor at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as a professor of law and also as the founding director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic. Dr. Bill Hing, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to join you, Jeff, and the audience.
Let me ask you, from your perspective, what's it going to take before Congress will take up fair and just immigration reform?
You're starting with a small question, I can see. It's going to take cooperation. Unfortunately, the kind of collaboration that we've seen throughout the years, I've been practicing immigration law for 50 years now, and I saw President Reagan sign major immigration reform in 1986 that granted legalization to 3 million folks. I saw a compromise in 1990. I saw a compromise that provided more business immigration. Even before 1986, I saw a compromise in 1980 for asylum reform. I saw John McCain step up and reach deals in the 2000s, only to be turned away as we began to see the politicization of immigration. And it will take a rethinking of how we treat human beings who are knocking at our border. It's going to take a rethinking, which I think is possible, before we're going to sit down and actually get some real progressive immigration reform passed.
You know, we see it characterized both by speeches of politicians and then by video that's brought over through the mainstream media. We see these images of people in huge numbers walking through Central America right up until they reach our doorway, and then coming across the border. It's when looking at that, you would think we're being overwhelmed. And I understand that there may be some very local places that get overwhelmed. But when you look at it, do non-citizens make up a larger percentage of our overall population than they have in years past?
No, not really. I mean, the decade that had the most immigrants per capita was actually the first decade of the 1900s, when we saw Eastern Europeans in particular and other Europeans coming to the United States. And I have to admit that did create a backlash. But that was the decade where we saw the most non-citizens. Yes, we do have, particularly in California, we do have a substantial population of non-citizens. For example, one in three California families has a non-citizen in their family. And there's a bigger percentage that if you expand the family size, there's a bigger percentage if you count parents and in-laws and grandchildren, that kind of thing. But we've always been a nation of immigrants. People forget that, even though we learned that in elementary school. And the images that you refer to of large numbers of people that are traveling through Mexico to get to the U.S. southern border, if you compare that with images of people who were on boats in the past decades, in airplanes from different parts of the regions, it's actually not that different in terms of the numbers. That's not something that we should be afraid of.
Seems that part of the problem, as I see it, is that historically we had people coming through the East, coming through this, you know, coming through Ellis Island and being processed with a fairly large staff to do it. And from the West, we had people coming through Angel Island, again, with large staff. They had places to house a lot of folks. A lot of folks were detained and held there until they figured it out. And with both of those disbanded, seems that now what we're watching is people walking across the border where there's really no apparatus set up to receive them.
Those are two very good examples, Jeff. And I don't, maybe you've, have you been to Ellis Island, Jeff?
Actually, I went briefly through there. My family went through there the year it opened.
Uh-huh.
On my father's side, that's when my family came in. I did not realize until after I had been there that I should have spent some time there. It was the 125th anniversary of when they opened it. Their name appeared somewhere.
Yeah. Because as your audience may recall, I can't remember what year that opened, but it is Lee Iacocca who actually raised most of the money for Ellis Island. The reason I'm pointing that out is that it's a great, great location for people to visit for a number of reasons. One is it reminds folks about the history of the United States as being a nation of immigrants and kind of the diversity, at least from the East Coast, of those that were entering. And you're absolutely right. The time that was taken to process and interview people. Not everyone's experience there was perfect, but most people did not get detained there for very long. Angel Island, in contrast, let's put aside Chinese for a moment, okay? It also had a large number of Asians and even some Russians that, believe it or not, they came through Angel Island. And you're right, they were processed and they were not detained for very long. But I hope that listeners in the Bay Area take an opportunity to go to Angel Island, because what you'll see is what I put aside for a moment is the history of Angel Island with respect to Chinese. And the reason that Chinese were actually detained for some time, in fact, My mother, I'm 75 years old, okay? And I was the youngest of a gigantic family. And my mother was detained in Angel Island for a week in the 1920s. My father was detained in Angel Island in the early 1900s for 3 months. Okay, so I'm very familiar with Angel Island. And the reason they were detained was because of something that many of listeners are aware of, something called the Chinese Exclusion Act. And because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, we were turning back, the United States was turning back folks that could not prove that they were U.S. citizens. If they were laborers, they would be turned back, even though they had, may have spent weeks or months on a voyage to the United States. And so,
you know, looking back at the Chinese Exclusion Act, it's kind of funny how we've come full circle. But back in those days, it seemed that we were most concerned about immigrant laborers coming over and putting our workers out. And now we're just exporting the whole operation overseas. And still those same folks are doing work elsewhere that might have been done here, but they just moved the factory as opposed to bringing workers in to run them here.
That's a great point, you know, because the debate over immigration has evolved a lot over the last decades. And hey, they're taking away jobs from us. And there still is a little bit of that that goes on. But your point is an excellent point. Would you rather have workers here paying taxes and adding to the local economy by spending money and having Social Security deducted? Would you rather have that, or would you rather have the job offshored? Well, I'll be honest with you, I'd rather have the jobs here in the United States, because in 2019 alone, undocumented immigrants contributed an estimated $9.7 billion in federal and state taxes and over $11 billion into the Social Security contributions. Okay, so they're helping. Non-citizen workers are helping keep our tax coffers whole as they can be. And especially the Social Security contributions, which those of us who are getting older, we're a little bit worried about that, making sure that we're going to get our Social Security contributions. And so that's a great point that we need those workers to keep a lot of our businesses going.
We've seen a lot of pictures in the media suggesting that non-citizens, and particularly those without documents, are responsible for a disproportionate amount of the crime here. Is that an accurate picture, or are most of the folks that are coming over here paying taxes, participating in the system, and not just avoiding arrest, but actually not, leading normal lives?
Yeah, the notion that immigrants, non-citizens, are coming here doing crime and that they have higher crime rates is an urban myth. That is absolutely false. Study after study shows that non-citizens have a lower crime rate than the average American population. And on top of that, undocumented migrants have the lowest crime rate. And so, no, that's definitely false, that immigrants have a high crime rate. But of course, when there is a non-citizen who commits a crime, certain politicians take advantage of that, and they'll make it headline news without any data. They'll just pick out that anecdote and point to that person who was a non-citizen who committed the crime, and there's immediate backlash over that. But in truth, the data is that non-citizens are community-minded. They're soccer coaches. They take their kids to school. They're all hardworking people that you would love living next door to and having as a neighbor, because they are law-abiding folks.
And the reality is, for many of us, they live amongst us, because few, if any of us, ask our neighbors whether they are here lawfully, whether they're citizens. We take a lot for granted. But people that live amongst us come from all sorts of different countries, especially here in California.
especially here in California and in the Bay Area, I have a different reaction than some people when I'm on the bus, and I'm a regular Muni bus rider, and I hear a lot of different languages. I smile about that. I love that, you know, because and it makes me want to learn another language, if you will.
They're talking about you.
They're probably talking about me, and they're probably right too. But you know, I remember my kids are in their 40s now, but I remember hiring a Russian. Actually, he was born in Ukraine. He was a professor of math in the old Soviet Union, and he came as a refugee, and he had been a professor, okay, and here he is tutoring local public high school students in math. But he so much enriched our lives. I just loved Anatoly. He was a fantastic gentleman. Then, of course, you know, we've had people who have cleaned our offices. We've had people that work in restaurants. But then we also have engineers, and we have other colleagues on the law faculty or in the university faculty. We have they are part of our community. We really are a nation of immigrants, and I really do think that we're the better for that.
So let's talk about people coming into this country. Somebody shows up at the border. They're claiming asylum. They're coming from a nation where things happen to people in ways that we all take for granted aren't going to happen here. Do we give them the benefit of the doubt? And if not, why not?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. There's so much for me to say. Where should I begin?
Let me ask you this. In my experience, and mine's obviously quite a bit more limited than yours, mm-hmm. but in the people I talk to and when I get immigration consultations, what I find is that the immigration policies are often not at all based on what the people truly experience in their home countries, but rather how friendly our government is at that particular moment with their government.
That's a big issue that immigration judges are often, they manifest the bias that the United States might have towards applicants who are from countries that the U.S. is not friendly with. Oddly enough, and I'm being sarcastic, get granted asylum at a higher rate than those applicants who are from countries that are our allies. And among our allies are Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And those are, over the last decade, those were the three of the largest sending nations. And so here's the problem. In the 1980s, I was privileged to be on the litigation team. I was one of the main attorneys in a Supreme Court case called INS versus Cardoza Fonseca, where, believe it or not, we got a 6-3 opinion that included Antonin Scalia as one of the six that agreed that we actually should give the benefit of the doubt to asylum applicants, that a 1 in 10 chance, let me repeat that, a 10% chance of persecution is enough to be granted asylum. 10%. But the way it works out is when you go to immigration court now, and these immigration judges, they'll look for some immigration judges will nitpick. They'll say, well, you know, why did the person say that he was attacked in July on his application, but in the courtroom, he said June? Or why did he say that there were three people that beat him up, but in the courtroom today, he said it was a gang, and instead of saying three people? I am not exaggerating. Some immigration judges are that nitpicky. And once they do that, they say, well, they're not trustworthy. They have a credibility problem. And here's the evidence that there's bias among the immigration judges. Anyone can go online and search. You just have to Google immigration judge asylum approval rates. That's all you have to Google. You can find the asylum approval rates for every immigration judge in the country by city. So you can find the names of all the immigration judges in San Francisco, all the immigration judges in Manhattan, all the immigration judges in Detroit, and you can see their percentage of asylum. Well, some immigration judges grant asylum at the rate of 70, 80%. But there are some immigration judges that grant asylum at the rate of 1 or 2% in the same city as other judges who have higher approval rates. There's something wrong with that picture. And to me, that means that those judges are biased and they're not giving the benefit of the doubt to asylum seekers. Let me say one other thing. These caravans, these large numbers of folks, I want listeners, I go to the border at least twice a year. I was just in the Arizona, the Mexico side of the Arizona border in October. I've been to Tijuana. I've been to Mexico. I mean, to the Texas, the Mexico side of the Texas border. These folks who often end up being our clients at the immigration clinic at USF, they are not out for a picnic. They're for a Sunday walk in the park. As you said, Jeff, they are leaving their countries because of violence. There is dangerous gang, cartel, and some instances, domestic violence that people are leaving. And they deserve to be heard. They deserve to have a chance to be treated fairly because they're not coming here. They're not even coming here just to look for work, okay? That may have been true decades ago for some Mexicans, but the truth is those that are coming today are coming because they're fleeing violence.
Let me turn it over to Donald from Foster City. Donald, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hey, thanks for having me on. So I have a question. I came to this country when I was 14, and about 10 years ago, I had a little problem where I ended up accepting a Prop 36 deal, and I completed it. I got it expunged a few years later. I had an attorney help me with that. And 2 or 3 years ago, when I traveled back to my native Italy, on the way back, I got flagged at the airport. They pulled me aside, told me to go to the customs office. When I got to the customs office, they told me that I really should go see a judge. And I was wondering if you have any idea what they were talking about.
And before I turn that call over to you, Bill, let me state for our listeners that are less familiar. When the caller says he took a Proposition 36 deal, what he's saying is that he entered a plea to a nonviolent drug possessory offense, which seems pretty innocuous under California law. Proposition 36 said you're not going to get jail time. You do a brief treatment program. It may be a class that you go to, but ultimately you have the chance to, at the end of it, get some relief. But ultimately, they're favoring treatment instead of punishment. But federal law is not always that favorable, is it?
It is not. Let me ask your question, your question, or one question before I answer the question. Have you seen an immigration lawyer yet?
No.
Okay. Well, you need to see an immigration lawyer who will consult with someone like Jeff or someone like one of Jeff's former guests, Carla Gomez. What you're treading on is a field of immigration law that overlaps with criminal law that has become a huge specialty. And it's called criminal immigration law or crimmigration. And so you need to get some good advice because here's the challenge. If you took a deal that led to a conviction that is classified as an aggravated felony, and we need to look it up. So somebody's going to have to look it up for you. That's why you need to talk with someone. If it's an aggravated felony, if you're not yet a citizen, even though you're a lawful permanent resident and you've been a lawful permanent resident since the age of 14, you may be deportable and you might not be eligible for any relief, okay? If it's a minor drug offense that's not considered an aggravated felony, you still may be deportable, but you might be able to apply for you may be able to apply for a waiver, okay? But you need to get an immigration attorney who knows what they're doing in order to handle this case properly.
Thank you.
Donald, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. So, closing thought for this half hour, but isn't the fight for immigrant and refugee rights really a forgotten part of the fight for racial justice?
You know, I'm pitching my own book here, but in my book, I go over in detail how race and racism has been ingrained in our immigration policies. And so there's a lot of examples of how Mexicans in particular have been picked on. We've talked about the Chinese Exclusion Act, and the anti-Asian stuff is still manifested in the backlogs of regular immigration visas. And so immigration justice really is about racism, because in fact the problem is that why do people come illegally? Because there aren't visas available for them. Why are there not visas available for them? Because the system has been rigged against them. Why is it that most people deported today facing deportation are actually Black or Latinx? And I do mean Black. And so there definitely is an overlap between immigration policy and racial impact.
A statement I remember President Trump mentioning while he was in office, when he commented, why do we have all these folks coming over from S-hole countries? We need more people from Norway.
That says it all.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and I'm pleased to announce that FeedSpot has rated this podcast, Your Legal Rights, one of the top 30 legal podcasts for non-lawyers. If you're looking around for legal content, just curious what else is out there, maybe you want to see how people look at this broadcast from other areas in the country, you can search top 30 legal podcasts for non-lawyers. You will see us prominently featured. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And now back to you, Jeff.
And actually, let me turn it over to Peter from San Francisco. Peter, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Great. I was interested in some of the subtleties that I don't think you've mentioned yet, which is, to what degree is this good business for the people that are hiring these folks in near slave conditions? They've, by demonizing immigrants and not giving them legal status, they minimize or eliminate any kind of complaints, health issue complaints, turning in the employer for violating any kind of laws, not paying them, underpaying them, not paying minimum wage, unsafe conditions, and so on and so forth. I think you get the gist of what I'm saying. It's the very people that are most anti-immigrant that seem to be the ones in a position to be hiring these folks, as opposed to the folks who seem to be more amenable to accepting immigrants and finding ways to citizenship.
You know, Peter, you bring up a question that I thought is rather interesting. It sounds like what you're saying is that this is another angle to turn back the clock 100 years and really parallels what we saw in the Cotton South. Have we created an economy that favors the exploitation of undocumented people?
Well, I think we have. And the fact that all sorts of folks are hiring undocumented people, all kinds of farm work, for example, is done by undocumented people. You know, if they were really serious about stopping immigration, why don't they crack down on anybody who hires somebody who isn't documented? But they don't seem to do that. They seem to basically just from time to time rack up the demonization and the pressure and the terror, really, that folks who are here working but not documented have to live under, because for them any kind of a complaint or a problem on the job isn't just a job, it's their whole family, it's their kids in school, it's a whole range of very dramatic and very serious consequences. So they're motivated basically to shut up, and that means you've got a malleable and a cheap and exploitable, easily exploitable labor force. So I think if politically people were serious, they would do a lot more to stop the employment of illegal folks, but that's not happening. And there's a reason. The folks who are exploiting the unlawful or undocumented people are the very ones that are happy that they be continuing on an illegal status so that they can continue to be exploited.
Yeah, it's a complicated topic. And first of all kinds of hiring goes on, as you know, Peter, that there's Silicon Valley hiring. That's something we could talk about later. That's debate up for debate too. That's all legal hiring. But you're right. There's a lot of undocumented hiring, and people are disincentivized to speak up because if they speak up, they might end up getting deported. The Supreme Court has had mixed statements with respect to rights to organize. It turns out that undocumented migrants do have a right to organize, but if they get fired for organizing and reported to ICE, they don't have a right to back pay. Okay, so where's the incentive? You're right for that. The ICE does enforce employer sanctions. There is a law against hiring undocumented workers, but usually it gets enforced against the big employers, where the government can go after tens of thousands of dollars in fine. They don't go after the small mom and pop thing. You're right, in terms of agriculture, agribusiness, there are a lot of undocumented workers out there, but there are also a lot of documented workers. There's a H-2B program for documented workers. And so I really think that one of the main ways of addressing this is to allow organizing, to allow the workers to organize without any worry of being deported for organizing. That's a big ask, okay? That's a big ask. I think that punishing employers for hiring undocumented immigrants, while that has appeal to it, it actually, that punishment, that threat of punishment drives the work even more underground. I have interviewed employers for papers that I've written on this topic, and they said, well, you know, we charge a tax. The reason we pay so little to a lot of our workers who are undocumented is that we tell them it's our insurance. We're taking a risk hiring you, and if we get fined, then I'm going to have to pay a fine for hiring you. That's why we're paying you so little right now, because we're keeping that money in case we get fined. And so it's kind of crazy logic, but we need the workers. That's clear. A lot of different employers need either low-wage workers or they need high-skilled workers, but there is a high, the unemployment rate in the United States is actually pretty low. And so there's evidence that we need the workers, not just for the the tax contributions that I mentioned earlier, but just to be productive. So I'm with you that we need to figure out a system to stop this exploitation and bring all this employment above ground.
You know, it's not just agriculture, but there's other fields that we haven't thought about or don't talk about so much that we're very dependent on. Textiles, putting clothes together, assembly line work, and probably most important of all, child care, senior care. These are all populated, perhaps an overrepresentation of those that are non-citizens and many non-documented individuals.
That's right. I mean, the senior example is a good one, Jeff, because so many of us are getting older and older in our life expectancy. That's a huge, huge challenge, is who's going to provide care for the elderly. And if you call any of these agencies up, and recently my family has had to do that for a family member, and most of the folks that they have available are non-citizens.
For those that have been a victim of a crime or a witness to a crime, they participate in the prosecution, and for some, they're rewarded with a special visa called a U visa. And that basically gives them, in essence, a jumpstart to a permanent residency. Is there any possibility that they'll establish at some point a parallel program for those that are working underground and that are not, you know, that are not given a subsistence wage? Any likelihood that organization will be somehow treated the same way, so that they won't have the ability to exploit to the extent that they are now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, just a review for the listeners, the U visa is available for somebody who's been the victim of a serious, usually violent crime. Okay. And so while shortchanging someone on the job may be a violation of civil law, maybe a violation maybe wage theft to a certain degree, and you're more of an expert than I am on this, it could reach a point where it could be a criminal problem for treating a worker that way. But because it's not a violent crime, they're not going to get a U visa. And I've tried one of those, however, and successfully, where there was also emotional exploitation. Because if you can supplement that application with a psychological evaluation that they were mistreated and paid below minimum wage, that it so affected them psychologically, it actually was recognized. Here's the problem, that this was one of your very first questions, does Congress have the gumption to actually step up and do the right thing for folks who have been exploited? Not right now. We need a new mindset on that. But to me, it's almost like trafficking, because what's interesting is that there is a T visa for somebody who's been trafficked, not just for sexual purposes, but for labor purposes. So if you can show that the person is working because they got that job through some kind of labor trafficking path, then they actually could apply for a T visa, and you don't need the kind of physical harm that a U visa does. But again, for your listeners, U visas are common. The public immigrant community often is aware of that, but there's a horrible backlog. There's only 10,000 visas available each year, and there's a backlog of several years now to get lawful permanent resident status through the U visa.
One of the calls that I think we've seen of late is, even without changing the laws, even without loosening up standards, even without trying to change fundamental fairness, we just need to invest money in putting some more immigration judges online so we can cut into some of these backlogs and try to make decisions so that if people are going to stay, get them to where they have their status. And if people are going to leave, get them out. But just get rid of these huge backlogs of cases, people. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're discussing humanity and immigration law with tonight's guest, professor, author, activist, Bill Hing from the University of San Francisco. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Still have a few minutes to call in. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7. The phone lines are closed.
On tonight's topic, we're talking immigration law, we're talking immigration policy, and you don't have to jump to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And one of the things that I've watched is the growth over the last few decades of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, which you founded. So that begs the question, how does one empower young attorneys to join this growing area and try to fight for social justice when every politician in the country points to immigrants as the cause for all of our woes?
You know, in some respects, Jeff, that question has actually generated, that challenge has generated more interest in immigration law. In other words, I love my students. I love the students that I have at USF. I love the ones that I had at Davis and the ones that I had at Stanford, and I still consider among my best friends those students that are out there practicing immigration law or other some kind of public interest law. And I agree with you. This rhetoric is bad. I don't think that it's clouded or discouraged law students from entering the field of immigration law, because it's a good field. It's an exciting field. You can be creative. It's funny. I was talking to a Microsoft immigration attorney. Microsoft actually has 6 immigration attorneys on their staff. And one of them, I had her be a guest speaker in my class, and she just went on and on about how much she loves immigration laws because you can be so creative in helping people. And she's absolutely right. And she thinks it's the best area of law to practice. And I agree with that, because it's very, very rewarding to help folks. I'm sure, Jeff, that when you get a not guilty plea, it's probably a happy moment for you in criminal. The best feeling in the world for immigration lawyers is when you win an asylum case or you get a green card for someone. It's just very rewarding. And you're invited to people's homes and they treat you like royalty, usually unnecessarily. But the real problem with the anti-immigrant rhetoric, and I'm the first to be critical of our current president, who I guess is waging the anti-immigrant border crisis rhetoric because he wants to be reelected. The worst thing is that it's causing this backlash that we're talking about. And people believe that it's a border crisis. People believe that folks are coming to do us harm, where there's nothing further from the truth. These are folks that are waiting at the border patiently. They're not entering, breaking through the walls. They want, the ones that I go and see twice a year at the border, they're waiting. They're using this kooky Border Patrol app to get an appointment, even though there's glitchy Wi-Fi. They're good people, and they're not trying to do us harm. And it's the rhetoric is preventing progressive immigration reform from happening.
As a criminal defense attorney in my day job, you really have to begin with a fundamental belief in the presumption of innocence. And I would imagine that with the immigration work, that you have led so many others to follow you and do, you really have to begin with a fundamental belief in humanity.
You know, I'm so glad that you stated that, because I just remember always looking into the eyes of our clients, and their eyes tell the story of who they are. And you just know that they are desperate and that they're telling you the truth. And the worst experience of my life was spending 3 days at a border patrol station in Clint, Texas in 2019, where I interviewed probably about 60 kids that were in detention at Border Patrol for more than 2-3 weeks. The whole team interviewed a couple of hundred that I was with. And these were kids that were lethargic. They were, it was before the pandemic, but they had the flu. They wanted to know when could they see their parents or their relatives. They had been separated at the border from aunts, uncles, grandparents. And they were given, the Border Patrol was so proud to tell us that they gave them 3 hot meals a day. You know what those 3 hot meals were? In the morning, they had instant oatmeal with hot water. For lunch, they had instant ramen, cup of noodles, basically, with hot water. And for dinner, they had a frozen burrito that was zapped in the microwave. And they had that same 3 meals for every day that they were there. And they were there for more than 2 weeks until they were transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. I'm determined, I hope in my lifetime, to be able to shut down the ability for ICE and the Border Patrol to at least detain children. We shouldn't be detaining children in this country. There's who have not committed any crimes. The worst thing that they've done is that they approach the border asking for help.
Let me take a call from Julie in San Francisco. Julie, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi, Julie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Okay. I also have an immigration-related question my relatives has a green card, and the green card is expired. The person is out of the country for more than 10 plus years because of the medical situation and wasn't able to come here. And now I'm looking for legal help. What should I do to bring the person here?
How long has the person been out of the country?
10 plus years.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, unfortunately, the person will be deemed to have abandoned their lawful permanent residence. They have to have some really, really good excuse to be able to defeat that. Usually we have luck if the person's just been out for maybe 2 or 3 years. You're not supposed to spend more than a year out of the country. But the only way, the person's going to have to re-immigrate. And so do they have a U.S. citizen spouse, or do they have a U.S. citizen adult son or daughter? If they do,
yeah,
then there's no waiting list for that category.
So the person has a daughter, a U.S. Citizen daughter, and a daughter applied for the renewal. She got the renewal notification from the USCIS.
Yeah, did they apply for a renewal of the green card or for a new immigrant visa?
A renewal of the green card.
Yeah, I'm surprised they were going to grant the renewal because they've been out of the country for 10 years. I would advise that daughter to file an I-130. It's a relative petition to start processing a new immigrant visa. It's going to take probably 6 to 12 months, but they should do that.
Okay. But is there anybody like offline I can speak with, some to give more background about the case?
Well, again, there are private, excellent immigration lawyers in San Francisco. I would go to the San Francisco Bar Association, and they have a lawyer's referral system. And maybe, I don't know if you've made that reference before or not, Jeff, but
absolutely. You could call them at 415-989-1616. They're one of the underwriters of this program. So every week we give out their number. It's 415-989-1616. And at a minimum, you will get referred to a private attorney. You'll have a consultation, a half hour consultation for a very small amount, somewhere in the neighborhood of $30, $40. But if it's an attorney you like, you found a great lawyer. They also have attorneys on staff for certain areas. So they would be a great resource to start.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your great advice.
Thank you for joining us. We wish you the best.
Thank you.
And let me turn it to Ivan from Newark. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for taking the call. Hey, I came over with some family in my guest visa expired, and I just never left. And I've been kind of flying under the radar for a long time, working for cash jobs, et cetera, and I'm getting tired of doing that. Is there any way that that I can just take a citizenship exam and become an American citizen?
I wish it was that easy, Ivan. Unfortunately, it's not. In order to become a lawful immigrant, you have to have a very close relative, like a spouse, a parent who's a citizen, or a sibling, although there's a big backlog in the sibling category, or you have to have a job skill that an employer is willing to go to bat for you and say that they cannot find a citizen who can do that job. Do you mind if I ask what's your marital status?
I'm single and I have a job skill, but how much is it going to cost the employer to sponsor such a thing?
In the neighborhood of several thousand dollars.
I don't know that anybody's going to do that. And the whole family is here on expired visas, so that's no good. There's no citizenship, but like if I became the citizen, then everybody could piggyback off of me and become a citizen somehow and apply, right?
More or less, you're right about that. But again, do you have any citizen children?
No.
Yeah.
No, okay. But so...
On the face of it, it doesn't sound like it, but you may want to give a call to the Bar Association for a consultation.
Is there anybody that I can, like, you know, pay a back taxes, not taxes, but you know what I'm saying, just, like, pay the fees to their favorite charity and move it forward in the line?
In the immigration line? No.
Yeah.
It's not... I those are great ideas. I wish there was a way to do that, but unfortunately, there's not.
But if Ivan goes to an immigration attorney and shows that he has unusual skills that are highly in demand, would that be a basis for him to get a different kind of visa?
Yes, it would. But and Ivan was asking, I think, on that.
But what, it costs the employer money, right? Because they got a sponsor.
Yes. Yes, there would be high fees for that.
But then again, if you had those outstanding skills, even if your lawyer doesn't want to pony up, maybe you could give the employer the money to pay the cost and have them sponsor.
I could probably do that. I have computer skills, so what was I going to tell you? But I can't just walk across the border and say, I'm a, what do you call it, refugee because I come from Northern Europe originally. So, you know, that's not going to fly at the southern border.
No, it's not. If you walk across the border, you're going to be subject to a 10-year bar from ever returning lawfully, because there's a 10-year bar for anyone who's lived in the United States for more than 1 year in undocumented status.
No, I just say I just got here. I just got here from,
I misunderstood.
I flew into Mexico City and walked up with a bunch of other people. I mean, I could pull that, right?
Well, it would be difficult. It would be difficult. I don't advise that.
I mean, you can't advise that, but there's like hundreds of people doing that every day, yeah?
And a better way to approach it, Ivan, might be to apply from the consulate, one of the consulate offices in Mexico, in the U.S. consulate, rather than coming across first. And you might have you might be treated better, I would think.
I know these guys are getting like hotels at the Ritz and stuff, and gift card or not gift cards, like debit cards and the whole shoot and match. Well, I want some of that.
Well, good luck to you.
Okay, thank you for joining us
in Your Legal Rights. We're down to about a minute, and I wanted to give a chance for Peter from Florida if you're still on the line.
Okay, I got to end with a little bit of a philosophical inquiry here because I'm thinking. There are no illegal immigrants in professional football. You can be offsides or out of bounds, but we accept that that's an artificial, that's a contrivance. You draw the borders, the boundaries there. But I suggest that in many ways, that's what national boundaries have become. Because I heard that before the United States, in the early 1800s, there were no illegal immigrants out west. They just went from Mexico, they freely went up north, and no one marked the boundary. And so they just, anyone lived with, like in a way, wild animals? No one was documenting them? Is that true?
That's true.
You could go from, if you lived in Mexico, it wasn't a matter of being a citizen of this or a citizen of that. The United States wasn't even states back then. Arizona wasn't a state, certainly. And you could just cross into it, and no one would harass you. No one asked
you. You neglect the fact that in those days, where we're sitting right now, was Mexico.
Oh, right.
Mexico had a border with Oregon.
Google something called the Treaty of Guadalupe, Guadalupe Hidalgo. And it was the United States actually defeated Mexico in a war and marched to Mexico City. And the United States took over, just as Jeff said, what is today. I think it's Nevada, Arizona, California, for sure. Those four states was all part of Mexico. But even then, even after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, people came and went across the border often, and it wasn't enforced.
Unfortunately, I have to end it. We are out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And tonight we've been discussing dehumanizing immigration. Our guest has been Professor Bill Hing from the University of San Francisco School of Law. Next week on Your Legal Rights, we take a look at workers' compensation law and administering medical care. Please tune in, and as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guest, professor, author, activist, Bill Hing. Please join us again on behalf of Your Legal Rights. We would love to have you back, and a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe, have a great night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.